Well, hi, this is Susan Glasser, and welcome back to the Global Politico. We are delighted to announce that we've hit a huge milestone here at the Global Politico, 50 episodes under our belt, 50 episodes, all of them really variations on a theme, trying to explain to you and to ourselves just what's going on in this world disrupted, whether we're talking about how the White House is supposed to work with Jim Baker, the legendary former White House chief of staff in our very first episode, thinking about the demise of liberal politics and centrism with Tony Blair, talking about the global refugee crisis with Ai Weiwei, talking about democracy with Condi Rice and Madeleine Albright. It's really been a pretty extraordinary year. We've had prime ministers and foreign ministers, spies and senators. We've gone to Iraqi Kurdistan and the Middle East. We've gone to the UK. And of course, we spent most of our time here at home trying desperately and not always succeeding to understand Donald Trump's Washington. So before we get to this week's episode, let me just say one more time how grateful I am to all of you for listening. Your emails and thoughtful responses each week mean so much to me. Please do email me anytime at sglasser@politico.com. And of course, go to Apple Podcasts. There you can sign up for our Global Politico newsletter, which you'll receive in your email each week. Of course, you can subscribe to the podcast, download it. You can rate us. I hope you'll give us a good rating. And now let's get to this, our final episode of the Global Politico in 2017. So I thought we'd end the year with what I'm thinking of are five big takeaways about Donald Trump and the world disrupted by the Trump presidency. Number one, we're all Trumpologists now. That's right. The whole world, basically, is waking up every morning, poring anxiously through Donald Trump's Twitter feed, trying to figure out what exactly is inside the mind and the head of this volatile new president, this unpredictable president in the White House who's intent on disrupting things. Well, many of our guests, of course, shared their insights from interactions with President Donald Trump, from their reading of this most unusual president. But I still think probably one of the most valuable conversations we had in understanding Donald Trump was at the very beginning. Senator Bob Corker got us started back in February, the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. He'd made a real study of Trump. He had flirted even with working in the Trump administration, had actually been interviewed by the president for the job of Secretary of State. And he told us in that interview, by the way, revealingly why he didn't get the job. One of the reasons was because he said he didn't agree with Donald Trump on any issue except for one, which he wouldn't name. But let's go back for our first takeaway in Trumpology, a lesson in Trumpology from Bob Corker. And he told us Donald Trump was a wrecking ball. The central issue, as he saw it, was could Trump evolve? And did he want to? Trump, he said, was torn between making deals, 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 and just wanting to blow everything up. Now listen to Bob Corker.
And I think the challenge is going to be, being honest, is so you want to do deals, 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 or you want to do you want to disrupt this and this and this. You've got to decide towards what end. And I think that's the place where hopefully our role here, but also those around him, can help channel and move to a place where you actually know why it is that you're disrupting, why it is you want to make a deal, towards what end are you moving, and hopefully there's a lot of work being done on that.
Well, in my view, that was the central tension of the year. Now, of course, Bob Corker posed that as a question back in February. We know his answer by now. When it came to the fall, Bob Corker had broken with Donald Trump and was warning publicly that Trump risked nuclear Armageddon and getting us all into World War III by mistake. Others have a different answer, but we'll leave you with that. Now, takeaway number two. If we're all Trumpologists, the rest of the world is also trying desperately to figure out what the hell is going on in Washington. As Richard Haass, the head of the Council on Foreign Relations, said to me for my upcoming magazine piece, if I only had a nickel for every time a world leader over the last year has asked me that question, what the hell is going on in Washington? And my second takeaway is simply this. The rest of the world thinks that we've gone crazy. except, I should say, in the Middle East, where perhaps they're just happy that Donald Trump is not Barack Obama. But basically, the rest of the world thinks he's all just as nutty as a lot of us here do. Here's some revealing conversations we had with world leaders over the past year that I think have stuck with me as we end 2017. First of all, there was this discussion with Carl Bildt, the former prime minister of Sweden. Not exactly Donald Trump's kind of guy, not exactly Donald Trump's kind of country. And in fact, an early revealing incident came when Donald Trump just retweeted one day an attack on Sweden, apparently based on a Fox News documentary that he saw that seemed to imply that there was a problem of Muslim refugees run amok in Sweden. And Carl Bildt here is talking with us about what happened in Sweden when Donald Trump tweeted an attack on the country.
Well, people were appalled. Then there was an element of sort of entertainment. They thought the man had gone bananas the one way or the other. They couldn't really understand it. So there was quite a big reaction to it, and it caused quite a big debate, both concerning the relationships and concerning the issues of substance that he tweeted about. But it was a somewhat unsettling thing to see the president of the United States, without any factual basis whatsoever, launch out against a small country.
And I think Carl Bildt's point, by the way, is an important one. It's not just the theater of Donald Trump. It's not just the spectacle of the Trump show and the tweets that has the world wondering what the heck is going on in Washington. But more substantively, a theme that's emerged throughout the year that we've discussed in many episodes of the Global Politico is Donald Trump's penchant both for praising authoritarians, but in particular for attacking and criticizing America's closest friends and allies. And we had a lot of conversations throughout the year, including, by the way, remember that prime minister of Montenegro who was shoved by Donald Trump at the NATO meeting? The same NATO meeting, by the way, where Donald Trump refused to reaffirm America's commitment to the mutual defense of our allies. Well, we talked with that prime minister. He had some interesting things to say. We also talked to a leader from the Middle East who later came into the news in not exactly the way he would have intended, Saad Hariri, the embattled prime minister of Lebanon. I thought he gave the Global Politico one of the year's most insightful views into why it is Trump is more popular in the Middle East, at least with its authoritarian leaders, than he is in other parts of the world.
The thing is about President Trump is the clarity in his discussions about things. That's what makes, I think, in the Middle East, comfortable.
So what is he clear on then?
You know, for instance,
I'm not clear.
What's clear is when you draw a red line and somebody passes that red line, you know, you do something about it. And I think that's the difference.
Hariri had one point of view. Another point of view on the Trump disruption and what it looks like to the rest of the world came in our exclusive interview this fall with Javad Zarif, the Iranian foreign minister who had negotiated the Iran nuclear deal, now under attack by Donald Trump. I spoke with Zarif on the sidelines at the very end of his visit to the annual United Nations General Assembly in New York. Remember that Donald Trump went to the UN General Assembly and attacked Iran in scathing terms from the floor of that UN General Assembly. Later, after our conversation, Trump decided to decertify Iranian compliance with the nuclear deal, even though his own government recommended against it, and even though the inspectors who are charged with actually determining whether Iran was in compliance said that actually they were in compliance with it. At the time, it was a subject of big debate, and I found it very fascinating to talk with Javad Zarif about the unintended benefits of Donald Trump beating up on you if you're Iran. It tends to make you have a much more compelling case and to have the rest of the world side with you, as he found and as he explains in this part of our conversation.
This deal has been the subject of thorough negotiations for 2 years. You cannot renegotiate just one aspect of the deal that one party doesn't like, because there are aspects of the deal that other parties don't like. It is just meaningless. And it proves that the U.S. is not a reliable negotiating partner for it to negotiate at length.
So that was the Iranian perspective. There's one other country, of course, that's occupied more of Donald Trump's bandwidth than any other, that's become perhaps alongside Iran the biggest enemy of Donald Trump's first year in office. That's North Korea, of course, and his very public feud with nuclear aspirational, nuclear armed leader Kim Jong-un. Now, a lot of ink has been spilled on, you know, Trump's attacks on Little Rocket Man, on his threats to wage fire and fury against the North Koreans. Many people have been scratching their heads, even now at the end of 2017. What does it all mean? Are we really closer to war with North Korea or not? Is it just public bluster? None of us knows. Well, I found our conversation with two folks who've been conducting secret Track 2, they're called, negotiations with the North Koreans for years, to be incredibly insightful. Basically, the bottom line, as Suzanne DiMaggio and Joel Witt told us in this episode of the Global Politico, is that even the North Koreans are wondering and asking the same question, is Donald Trump crazy? So that brings us to our third takeaway. The rest of the world is puzzling about Donald Trump, but part of the reason I think we're all having such a hard time figuring out what is American foreign policy 1 year into the Trump administration is because there's an inherent schizophrenia of Trump's foreign policy. We're facing a unique situation today where there's a foreign policy of the President of the United States and the foreign policy of his advisors, and that is not the same thing. This is an incredible tension we've seen revealed most recently this week in the new national security strategy of the United States, which got very high marks, I would say, more or less from the establishment in both parties who saw it as a fairly mainstream conventional document. But they said it doesn't necessarily mean that Donald Trump supports any of it. He's shown over and over again his willingness to disregard the advice of his own advisors, respected people he's brought in to the administration, like Jim Mattis, the defense secretary, Lieutenant General H.R. McMaster, his national security advisor, and of course, his beleaguered Secretary of State Rex Tillerson. And I think that's one of the signature issues, whether it's Afghanistan and NATO, the Iran nuclear deal, and of course, the biggest dispute, Russia, what to do policy-wise. Often there is a distinction between Trump, the original America Firster, and the much more mainstream Republican advisors who are there serving him. And throughout the year, I think we had various illuminating conversations on the Global Politico that showed us a little bit where that internal fight for the heart and soul, if you will, of Trump's foreign policy is at. Here is Tom Cotton, the Arkansas Republican senator who's emerged as one of Trump's closest outside advisors, closest remaining supporters among Senate Republicans who really pay attention to foreign policy. I was lucky enough to talk with Senator Cotton right in the middle of that Iran nuclear fight, right when he came, a few hours after he came from a White House meeting with Donald Trump. His position, by the way, ultimately prevailed with Trump. He was getting Trump to stop short of blowing up the Iran nuclear deal and pulling out of it entirely. But he agreed that Trump should go ahead and come up with this decertification of the nuclear deal as a way of showing his displeasure with it. So that was the conversation with Tom Cotton. But what I found most revealing was two things. First of all, listen to him here as he talks about just how mainstream he thinks Donald Trump's foreign policy is. He's basically telling us, don't pay attention to the tweets. Don't focus too much on this inflammatory rhetoric from Donald Trump. Pay attention to what he does. Here's what Cotton said here.
Every Republican voted against the nuclear deal. Everyone believes that it's a bad deal. And I think if the president takes that course of action, they'll by and large support him.
And this is a pretty important but. You can feel the rising sense of tension and the palpable feeling that there's an internal rift. This conversation happened right in the middle of a huge controversy this fall over Secretary of State Rex Tillerson. He was reported to have called Donald Trump a bleeping moron. By the way, to this day, he's never personally denied this. I think most of the sources I've spoken with believe it was true. So you have this crazy situation where the Secretary of State has called his boss a moron. He was disagreeing with Trump about the Iran nuclear deal and many other issues. And Tom Cotton really reflected, I think, Donald Trump's fury at realizing he's stuck with a bunch of national security advisors who don't basically share the same views that he does. Here's what Tom Cotton had to say about that.
When you think the president is wrong, you have a duty to try to present to him the best facts and the best thinking to help him see it in a different light. And maybe you can, but if he doesn't, and he says, no, I want to do it my way, then your job is to move out and execute. And if you feel strongly enough, then you have to resign.
Finally, I'd like to close this item number three with the Russia issue. Russia, Russia, Russia has been the theme of 2017. Not only Trump's puzzling and persistent affection for Vladimir Putin. He's never, even after all the controversy, he's never personally criticized Putin. And in fact, he actually ended the year in a series of what appear to be mutual admiration phone calls with Vladimir Putin, even at the same time as he was rolling out a new national security strategy that was written by H.R. McMaster and his team at the National Security Council that calls Russia, along with China, a major geopolitical threat to the United States that the U.S. is committed to countering at every turn. There's just no way to square this circle, folks. It's just puzzling and confusing. And ultimately, as I wrote a month or so ago, after this conversation with Kurt Volker, schizophrenic. Kurt Volker is Donald Trump's special envoy to negotiate with the Russians over the ongoing war in Ukraine. Here's what Kurt Volker had to say about how that's going. Let me ask you, Ambassador, what is the percentage chance that they're still fighting in eastern Ukraine a year from now?
I'd say it's at least 80%.
80%.
I think that there's a chance that there won't be, but the most likely scenario is that this continues.
And I have to say, my Russia hand friends in both parties don't fundamentally disagree with anything that Kurt Volker had to say. There's just one problem with it. No one, and I mean no one, thinks that Donald Trump agrees with any of it. All right, item number four. Let's face it, one thing we've learned in 2017, and we're about to relearn it all over again in 2018, that's important, is that the Republicans are at war with each other. And, by the way, America's partisan fights and fights over what to do and say and think about Donald Trump are now the world's partisan fights. It's only going to get worse in 2018 with midterm elections losing. So what have we learned about the Republican war within when it comes to foreign policy? Well, we've got globalists versus the America firsters. We've got neocons who've abandoned their party and see Donald Trump as the ultimate betrayal. We've got Washington pragmatists who are trying desperately and not always succeeding at figuring out how to work inside this administration. And of course, we've got the true Trump believers, the Bannonites, the economic nationalists, the populists who want to see a very, very different American foreign policy than the one we've had from both parties over the last few decades. Here's three revealing conversations, I think, on the Global Politico that get at this Republican war within for the soul of the party when it comes to foreign policy. First, there was this conversation we had this spring with Condoleezza Rice, the former Secretary of State and National Security Advisor for George W. Bush. Of course, she's permanently connected with the war in Iraq that Donald Trump now says is a terrible, terrible mistake. Rice had come out with a book about democracy of all subjects and how it's at the core of the American identity and its foreign policy in the world. It was both incredibly well-timed and incredibly poorly timed. And I think this conversation that we had back in the spring really revealed the deep discomfort that the Republican establishment feels about Donald Trump. How do you square the circle of being the country and the party that's all about promoting democracy and human rights overseas when you have a president who everybody knows doesn't care one bit about democracy promotion, is more comfortable praising authoritarians and autocrats than he is with America's European allies? And so I think this clip from Condoleezza Rice really gets at that inherent tension of the Trump presidency for the establishment Republicans.
Words do matter. And I follow every day what we're saying. I hope that we will say even more, that the world is really a dark place when the United States of America is not involved. It's a dark place when we don't stand up for those who just want to have the same basic values that we have.
But look, let's be real. The war is not going to be fought this time on Condoleezza Rice's terms. Listen here, if you will, to Roger Stone, who's been a friend and advisor and political confidant of Donald Trump on and off for several decades. Roger Stone spoke with us as part of a conversation this fall about the Republican war within and how it would play out. And, you know, it's just amazing to listen to him attack what he calls the globalists like H.R. McMaster and to really wage war against what he sees as the establishment in his own party that's determined to bring Donald Trump down.
He can certainly score in the midterm elections. He may just have to run against both parties to do it. That's what I would recommend. I'd throw Mitch McConnell and the boys over the side so fast your head would spin.
Well, the party is breaking apart, not just because of the globalists and the America Firsters, but you also have this band of never-Trumpers it's particularly strong and pronounced in the national security field. These folks organized themselves way back in the 2016 primary campaigns to speak out against Donald Trump in a way that is very unusual at a time when most of the rest of the Republican Party, maybe unhappily, has sort of fallen in line. And certainly the elected officials on Capitol Hill, with very rare exceptions like Bob Corker, have spoken out against Donald Trump. But for the most part, right, they've hung in line with Donald Trump. They're seeing their fortunes rise and fall with him. That's been much less true on the Republican foreign policy and national security establishment. And I think that's a big part of the war within. Our fifth and final takeaway of the year in the global Politico. My takeaway here is something a little bit different, but we talked a lot about Donald Trump so far in this hour. But I want to end by talking about the revolutions that don't just come from above. You could argue that these are, some of them at least, unintended side effects or consequences of the election of Donald Trump. But nonetheless, this has been a year when an awful lot has happened that maybe did genuinely surprise us, or that happens outside of the context of what is going on inside that crazy, backbiting sneak pit of a White House just a mile or so away from where we're sitting and having this conversation here in Washington. Revolutions can happen anywhere. Look at the revolution from above that's happening in Saudi Arabia. Look at the crisis from all around that's happening in Venezuela. In fact, one of our most popular episodes of the year had very little to do with Donald Trump and all about what happens when a democracy dies in Venezuela. There was an absolutely compelling firsthand account we heard from Hannah Dreyer, a young correspondent for the Associated Press, who spent the last several years living in Venezuela and watching as that country crumbled around her. We also heard about the revolution that might be coming in the future, one that has to do with a crisis that doesn't get nearly as much attention as it ought to. That's the crisis of literally hundreds of millions of people on the move around the world, the global refugee crisis. There are more people living as refugees and migrants, many of them forced migrants, at this time than at any time since the end of World War II. I was moved beyond belief by my discussion with Ai Weiwei, the famous Chinese dissident and artist who decided on his own to make a movie and travel around the world to more than 30 countries looking at the plight of these refugees, empathizing with them, talking with them, and I think in his own way spotlighting a foreign policy crisis that doesn't get attention that it deserves while we're sitting around performing our acts of Trumpology every morning and reading the president's Twitter feeds. Another kind of revolution that we had this year came from a most unlikely place. If a Chinese dissident can make a movie about global refugees from Syria, then you can have top secret intelligence professionals become political pundits and commentators in a way none of us ever expected. I learned more from my conversation with Jim Clapper than almost anyone else, the former American director of national intelligence. This is a man who devoted 40 years of his life to the most top secret institutions of the American government. Something in him, I think, snapped with the election of Donald Trump. And he has spent the last year in the most public opposition to Donald Trump of almost anyone in the so-called deep state. Jim Clapper's emergence has got to rank as a revolution, especially because he's been joined by some other very serious intelligence professionals, people who dedicated their careers in a very nonpartisan way to serving presidents of both parties, but have now become almost a public interest group out there commenting and engaging with what's going on in the Trump presidency. Here's Jim Clapper.
The Russians succeeded, I believe, beyond their wildest expectations. Their first objective in the election was to sow discontent, discord, and disruption in our political life, and they have succeeded to a fare-thee-well. They have accelerated, amplified the polarization and the divisiveness in this country. As it is, this is going to continue to be a cloud, not only over the president, but the office of the presidency, the administration.
Finally, a revolution that's long overdue, and one that I personally have welcomed in every way, which is to say the revolution of women speaking out, fighting back, saying me too, saying what's not acceptable in our public life, in the national security world, and of course, well beyond it. Perhaps this is an unintended side effect of the election of Donald Trump, in that you have people speaking out in ways that they might not have had America elected its first woman president. I don't know the answer to that. But as we end the year in the middle of this unprecedented backlash towards sexual harassers, I think we have to say there is a revolution of sorts happening in Washington and around the world, really, as a result of it. We started the year, by the way, positing that Donald Trump would have a very alpha male foreign policy. And here's a clip from our discussion with Madeleine Albright and others talking about Donald Trump's alpha male foreign policy.
Some of the way that they've been carrying on policy has not been able to put themselves into the other person's shoes in order to recognize what our national interests are. And so I've been to many Munich security conferences, as have my colleagues here, and we have always been kind of the center of attention because we are the United States, and what we wanted to do was what people wanted to know, what our plans were, how we were operating with others. This time, we were still the center, but the center of doubt.
Well, why did I bring it up? As we talk about the Me Too movement at the end of the year, this revolution that we're seeing here. Well, because I think there is a connection, and one that we can't forget about, between the incredible lack of representation here of women in positions of power in Washington and what's really going on with this sexual harassment backlash. In November, after the revelations about Harvey Weinstein, after various media figures had been sacked, including, by the way, also the resignation of the defense minister of the United Kingdom, I sat down with six of the smartest, most badass ladies in national security I could, and we had a revelatory conversation about this world of everyday harassment and this culture of sexism that has persisted perhaps more than in many other fields in the space of national security and foreign policy. I hope you'll listen and take seriously what they had to say about this culture of sexism in our lives and how each of us can do something to get rid of it.
I remember starting at the Pentagon 10 years ago, and so many of the stories that we've heard about men saying wildly inappropriate things, or in my case, the special forces men kind of changing clothes in the middle of the office and walking around in their underwear, or talking about developing a calendar of sexy women in the office. I thought that was just a cost of doing business in the Pentagon when I was 24, 25 years old. And it's interesting, like for the longest time, I had more or less ignored a lot of those kind of behaviors. And then in the last year or so, as they come back to me, I think, wow, why on earth did I not say anything at that point in time? That has been a kind of terrifying moment for me of like, what did I accidentally walk by?
All right. So that's my five takeaways from our 50 episodes of the Global Politico in 2017. Who knows what 2018 will bring, but I'm sure that the theme of this podcast will remain Donald Trump and what it's like to live in a world disrupted. In the meantime, I just want to thank all of you for listening to the Global Politico each week. I am so gratified and overwhelmed by all the support we've gotten from listeners literally around the world. I can't tell you what those emails mean, those signs of support, the suggestions from listeners that have helped to shape and guide our programming. Keep it coming. I hope if you're new to the Global Politico, you'll sign up for our newsletter, you'll subscribe to us, you'll rate us on Apple Podcasts or whatever is your favorite podcasting platform. And I can't end 2017 without saying a big thank you to the entire team at Politico that has helped to make Global Politico possible. That starts, of course, with our indispensable and fantastic producer, Bridget Mulcahy. There's the entire team at Politico Magazine, which helps to produce and edit the column each week, Katie Fawcett, Zach Stanton, and all the rest. And, of course, my editor, at Politico Magazine, my partner in founding the magazine, and all around brilliant partner since our days together at Foreign Policy, Blake Hounshell. Of course, my shadow editor, my husband, Peter Baker of the New York Times, and the entire leadership team of Politico, which has supported this project so robustly, owner Robert Albritton, editor-in-chief John Harris, editor Carrie Budoff-Brown. Thank you again, and here's my best wishes to all of you as we look ahead to 2018.